Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Before we begin, a quick warning. This episode includes details about domestic violence. We know this can be difficult to hear, so please listen with care and use discretion if you need to skip or step away. And if you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, help is available through the National Domestic Violence Hotline by calling 1-800-799-SAFE or 1-800-799-7233. Last week, you heard the prosecution's case against Leo Schofield. Jurors were told that Leo was not the loving husband he appeared to be and heard a story of jealousy, rage, and a brutal cover-up. A husband who snapped and parents who helped him hide the truth. There were neighbors who heard fighting, a father who said God led him to the body, and one star witness who described to the jury what she believed to be the final moments of Michelle Schofield's short life. According to the state, it was the result of a young marriage consumed by violence and a husband whose temper had finally exploded. And statistically, that story made sense. In most homicides, the first and most likely suspect is usually the spouse. Add in a history of arguments, a sudden disappearance, and a father claiming divine intervention, and the theory practically writes itself. But what if that assumption blinded everyone to the truth? What if everything the state built, the testimony, the timeline, and motive, wasn't proof of guilt, but proof of how easily the wrong theory can take hold? When the defense took the floor, the jury heard a very different story, straight from the Schofields themselves. According to the defense, the state's story had one fatal flaw, its timeline. And if the state was wrong about that, everything else might come crashing down. And stay tuned until the end of the episode for some extra details that confirm one version of events and shatter the other. But even with that new information, the question remains the same. Did the jury get it right? The prosecution says Leo's rage ended Michelle's life. The defense says injustice destroyed his. But it's the jurors who have the final say. This is the 13th Juror Podcast, where we break down real court cases and put you in the juror's seat. Two sides, the same evidence. You decide what to believe. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell. Today's episode is Florida versus Leo Schofield, Part 2, The Defense. The case against Leo Schofield Jr. was purely circumstantial. There was no murder weapon, no eyewitness, and not a single piece of physical evidence linking Leo to his wife's murder. In cases like this, the state often asks jurors to connect dots rather than see them point blank. These dots, the behavior, the timing, and the coincidences, when pieced together, are meant to tell a story. For the defense, a circumstantial case presents an opening, because when guilt hinges on a specific interpretation, that interpretation can always be challenged. And that's exactly what defense attorney Jack Edmund set out to do. In his opening statement, Edmund kept it simple. This case wasn't about emotion. It was about evidence. Leo Schofield wasn't on trial for being a bad husband or having a temper. He was on trial for murder. With no alternate suspect to point to, the defense's strategy was clear. Dismantle the state's theory by challenging their timeline and showing that the story the prosecution told simply couldn't have happened. Based on the evidence and testimony they presented, this is the defense's version of events. The state had a deliberate strategy to shape the image of Leo Schofield in the jurors' minds as a violent man filled with rage. And Edmund knew if he couldn't alter that image, jurors would never truly hear anything else he said. So before he even touched the timeline, he started with character, chipping away at the prosecution's foundation by questioning credibility, exposing contradictions, and reminding jurors that what they'd been told wasn't fact, but perception. Stories change, memories fade, and when investigators start crafting a theory, sometimes witnesses will shape their memories to fit it. Edmonds started small, pointing out minor inconsistencies that, on their own, might not have seemed important. Like Mrs. McClelland, who testified she often saw Leo shoving Michelle outside their home. But in her police statement, she said it happened only twice and that they may have been playing around. Or Ed Vachon, who prosecutor John Aguero claimed would describe Leo as a man with a violent temper. But in reality, he told jurors Leo and Michelle got along fine when he was around. Then there's the kick that Andersons testified about. Leo said it was playful, that he gave Michelle a light kick, called her Miss Attitude, and she smirked back. There were other things, too, like the claim that Leo once said he might have blacked out and killed Michelle without realizing it. According to Leo, that's not at all what happened. Someone asked him if it was possible, and he said no. He remembered every minute of that night. To prosecutors, Leo's fear that Michelle might be in the water showed guilt. But the defense reminded jurors why Leo said that. Just a few years earlier, headlines in Central Florida were dominated by the abduction and murder of 6-year-old Adam Walsh after his severed head was found in a canal. When Michelle went missing, that case haunted Leo and forever reminded him of what could happen to missing people in Florida. Leo acknowledged his friend's testimonies about him, but he chalked it up to young people whose tempers were flaring. For example, it wasn't Leo who threw the lamp and broke the stereo. It was Mary Morehouse. And the neighbor Mary left the scene with confirmed no chair ever came through the window. Dean and Melissa were evicted. They didn't leave because of Leo. And it was Dean who punched the hole in the wall before they ever even moved in. Leo said he's not surprised neighbors heard noises, but who knows where it actually came from. Edmund turned to the stories Leo said were completely false. Like the one about him stabbing himself in the leg during a fight. Leo said that never happened and told the jury that if he could show them his leg, they would see there's no scar. Ed Collins, who testified he saw Leo fly off the handle at home, admitted he'd never even been inside Leo's house and had never seen Leo act violently. One by one, Edmund showed the jury how these stories had shifted and how rumor and hindsight can blur into what a person perceives as memory. This was an important part of Edmund's strategy, but defending against abuse allegations is always dangerous ground because believing victims and their advocates matters. When multiple people take the stand and say they witnessed anger and fear, it's hard not to wonder if there's truth somewhere in it. But the defense's job wasn't to erase what may have been real. It was to question what had been exaggerated, reshaped, or repeated until it became a defamatory narrative, pointing fingers toward his client as a murderer. Edmund wasn't asking jurors to see Leo Schofield as a saint. He was asking them to see how a young couple's volatile relationship had been retold through a lens of suspicion. Somewhere between the image of a monster and the myth of a perfect husband lies the messy, complicated truth, which even Leo admitted wasn't pretty. He admitted there were fights. He did have a temper, and there were moments he wasn't proud of. There were 3 times he slapped Michelle, one of them across the face. Afterwards, he walked out in tears, ashamed. In fact, the first person who ever told police that Leo hit Michelle was Leo, and it was long before there was a trial, a theory, or a motive to lie. And that's what Edmund wanted jurors to remember. How pieces of a story can be taken, repeated, and reshaped until they become something unrecognizable. Then Edmund turned to another story he said had been badly distorted over time, one that shaped not only the public's perception, but the entire investigation itself, how Leo Schofield Sr. found Michelle's body. From the moment detectives heard that Leo Sr. claimed he was guided by God to the canal where Michelle was found, suspicion turned sharply toward him. To investigators, it sounded unbelievable, and even the newspapers seemed to mock him. But when Leo Sr. took the stand, he told the story in his own words. He said Michelle had meant a great deal to him, and when she disappeared, he refused to believe she was gone. For days, he drove the same stretches of road again and again, calling out her name, praying that somehow, through instinct, faith, or something larger than himself, he might be led to her. He and Leo had lost faith in the sheriff's office and believed law enforcement wasn't taking the search seriously. So they made flyers, posted them around town, and organized their own searches. Michelle's car had been found abandoned along Interstate 4, so that's where they began their search, working backward toward town, mile by mile. When those searches turned up with nothing, Leo Sr. turned onto State Road 33, which intersected the highway close to where Michelle's car was discovered. It wasn't random, he said. A dirt path caught his eye, littered with trash and tire marks, so he followed it. Something in his gut told him to keep going. Not a voice, just a feeling. Then, through the brush, he saw what looked like a piece of clothing. He pushed forward through the palmettos and saw her. Panicked, he sprinted back up the path, waving down a passing truck, shouting that he'd found his daughter-in-law and needed help. When Edmund asked if he believed the hand of God had led him there, Leo Sr. said yes. He didn't hear voices, but felt something in his heart urging him forward. It's a familiar phenomenon for any crime junkie. A mother jolted awake with a sense that something's wrong. A detective who follows a hunch that makes no logical sense, but turns out to be right. A parent who can't explain why they turned down a certain road, only for it to change everything. Whether you call it intuition, instinct, or divine intervention, it sometimes is interpreted in different ways. For Leo Schofield Sr., every time he tried to explain what led him to that canal, detectives became more suspicious. What he saw as faith, detectives saw as guilt. All of these stories, the violence, the temper, the voice of God, were told to shape the way jurors saw Leo and his father. Edmund admitted Leo Schofield was not a perfect man. He had a temper. He argued. He made mistakes. But the difference between imperfection and murder lies in proof, and the state didn't have it. And at the center of every accusation, every witness, and every theory was a single fatal flaw: the timeline. The testimony of star witness Alice Scott was dramatic, intense, and the key to the prosecution's theory. On the night of Michelle's disappearance, she heard a noise, looked out her window, and saw Leo and Michelle pull into the driveway and go inside. There was yelling, screaming, loud noises, and then silence. Leo left alone, returned, backed the Mazda into the driveway, then carried out something heavy and drove away. Michelle was never seen again. It's a chilling image. But there's a problem. Actually, there are lots of problems. According to Alice, all of this happens between 1:30 and 3 a.m. But it's during that time that Leo and his mother are confirmed to have been seen by Michelle's dad, as well as by three deputies in a gas station parking lot where he told them about his missing wife. If Alice's story were true, Leo would have had to murder Michelle, clean up, move her body, dump it miles away, abandon her car, and still appear in two other places across town, all within the same hour and a half. That seems impossible. Alice couldn't even keep her story straight. She wasn't sure which night she saw the incident in question, and she brushed it off, saying, "I'm not good with dates anyway." As for corroboration, there was none. Alice's husband testified he never saw a thing, only that he remembered Alice waking him up one night. Her sister-in-law, Linda Sells, said the night Alice described actually happened a couple of weeks earlier, and their fence line conversation wasn't panicked at all. They'd been laughing. Alice even joked, "Something's going on over there. Better hurry up and get inside." Hardly the reaction of someone witnessing a murder. When Leo was asked on the stand whether he carried anything heavy to his car, he said, yes, he carried out an amplifier for band practice. But band practice was before the night Michelle went missing, which corroborated Linda Sell's account. Then came a fatal contradiction. On the stand, Alice Scott was asked the last time she ever saw Michelle Schofield. Her answer? Around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the day before she went missing. If that's true, her 1:30 a.m. story can't be true. Even more alarming, Alice told jurors her window was about 20 feet from the Schofields' trailer. Investigators later measured it as 160 feet, 8 times farther than she had estimated. And there was a line of trees between them. From that distance through that cover, she couldn't possibly have seen the front door, much less what Leo was carrying. Edmund pushed Alice on other details too, like why she never mentioned the carpet cleaner to detectives, or her supposed talk with Linda at the fence line, and how, with a supposed bad back, she was able to climb onto a counter and kneel there for 20 minutes to spy on her neighbors. Alice also said loud voices are what made her get up and look in the first place, but she also claimed she saw the car pull in. So how could she hear an argument that wasn't happening yet? Every detail pointed to one conclusion. Alice Scott's story didn't add up. And when it fell apart, so did the state's timeline. If Leo was across town talking to multiple people as they all testified, then whatever Alice saw that night wasn't murder, and it couldn't have been Leo Schofield. Timing turned out to be an issue with other witnesses, too, like the LaFoons, who said in late February, between 3 and 4 a.m., they saw Michelle's Mazda and a blue pickup truck on State Road 33. They almost stopped until they saw people near the truck and assumed help had arrived. The LaFoons knew Leo's family, but couldn't identify any of them as being the people they saw. And they couldn't pin down the date. Was it before the car was found? After? No one could say for certain. Then there was the man from Ohio, vacationing in Florida. He testified that around 9 p.m. one night, he saw two men with dark hair walking out of a wooded area near I-4 and State Road 33, along with a light-colored pickup truck. The next afternoon, in the same area, he saw police everywhere. A few hours later, he read about Michelle's body in the newspaper. But those details don't quite fit. He said he saw the men after merging back onto the interstate, at 45 miles per hour. If that's true, it doesn't contradict Leo and his father's account of searching along I-4. It supports it. And about that newspaper the man from Ohio said he read after seeing the police everywhere near I-4, that detail sent me down a rabbit hole, looking into every local paper that could have hit stands that same night. The Ledger, the Tampa Tribune, the Orlando Sentinel, you name it. All morning prints with no regular evening edition. Maybe an insert could have been added. But realistically, it's unlikely he could have read about Michelle's body in the paper just hours after it was found, which once again calls into question the timeline of when any of this actually happened. Even the timeline built around Leo's day didn't hold. Prosecutor Aguero suggested that Leo's behavior on Wednesday was suspicious because he went to work with Jim Anderson, despite his wife being missing, but quickly left, went to the police department around lunch, and talked to a sheriff's deputy right before that. Aguero said Leo and his father were shopping jurisdictions to build an alibi. But once again, the state's timeline was debunked. According to Leo, they went to the police department around 9 that morning in hopes that a different jurisdiction would offer more help than the sheriff's department. They talked to an officer at the police department who said he'd call the sheriff's office to send a deputy out. That deputy arrived at 10:32 a.m. All of that means Leo couldn't have gone to work with Jim Anderson, and it couldn't have been lunchtime when he and his father arrived at the police department. Prosecutors suggested the pair was lying, but the actual evidence supports the defense's timeline, not the state's. And as for the accusation of them shopping jurisdictions to strengthen an alibi, although Leo had reported Michelle missing to the sheriff's office several times, there was still no record, no report, and no bolo. They didn't need an alibi. They were simply desperate for help. Over and over, Edmund tore apart the story Aguero had presented as fact. When he got to the police reports, the contradictions multiplied. He reminded jurors that memory fails everyone. And if vague timelines make Leo look suspicious, then the same standard should apply to the state's witnesses too. When the jury compared them side by side, it was Leo's story, not the state's, that continually lined up with the actual evidence. If the timeline was the backbone of Leo's defense, then forensics were the heart. Evidence doesn't have an unreliable memory, exaggerate, or change its story. And Edmund would argue that the clearest proof of Leo's innocence lies in these physical details. The medical examiner testified that Michelle had been stabbed 26 times. She would have lost 2 to 3 pints of blood externally. That's nearly half a gallon. If she'd been killed inside that trailer, investigators should have found a scene covered in blood. But they didn't. Luminol testing showed a few faint reactions, but that doesn't always prove the presence of blood. Luminol can react to alcohol, cleaning products, even vegetables. When those samples went to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, the results were clear. No human blood detected. So the defense asked the obvious question. If Michelle was killed there, where was the blood? Leo admitted he'd borrowed a carpet cleaner. But that was weeks earlier, he said, to clean up after their new puppy. Detectives who searched the trailer confirmed the carpets didn't appear freshly cleaned. And if Leo had tried to scrub away a murder, traces would have soaked beneath the carpet, but none were found. The small amount of Michelle's blood in the back of the car was far more likely to have come from the blood on the Downy bottle, not a body stabbed 26 times. Meanwhile, about 27 feet from the canal where Michelle's body was discovered, investigators found 2 blood spots in the dirt, and nearby, 9-foot-long drag marks leading toward the water. Her back had scratches that were consistent with being dragged. This evidence suggested she'd been stabbed at that location and dragged into the canal, not killed somewhere else and transported. Investigators lifted 4 fingerprints from the Mazda, but were unable to give any definitive answers on those. Not during trial, at least. To believe the prosecution's theory, the jury would have to ignore the forensics, disregard multiple witnesses, and assume almost everyone except for Alice Scott was either lying or mistaken. And they'd have to believe that a man capable of a brutal, vicious murder didn't leave behind a single trace of blood on his clothes, carpet, or car. Once Edmund finished presenting the defense, it was time for his final appeal to the jury. The state had spent weeks painting Leo Schofield as a violent husband who snapped, an image that was hard to shake. But after everything the jury had heard, the contradictions, the distances, the forensics that didn't fit, Edmund reminded them of their duty to judge facts, not feelings. He told them that the state had theories, but he had evidence. He showed inconsistencies in their witnesses, false assumptions in their timeline, and a complete absence of proof tying Leo Schofield to the crime scene. He turned toward the jury box and asked the question that would linger long after he sat down. Wouldn't you like to know, for example, if someone else's fingerprints were in that Mazda? Wouldn't you like to know if there was a strange fingerprint in that automobile? Those questions were important in a case built entirely on circumstantial evidence. He told them the prosecution's story only worked if they ignored everything that contradicted it, and to believe their story required impossible leaps. 2 versions of the same story had been told, and now jurors would have to decide which one they believed. Jurors reviewed hundreds of exhibits that all seemed to lead in different directions, but the truth was, after more than 2 weeks of testimony, they had little physical evidence to guide them, just a story told 2 different ways. 2 hours passed before the jury sent word. They had reached a verdict. Leo stood as the clerk read the words that would alter the rest of his life. We, the jury, find the defendant, Leo Schofield, guilty of first-degree murder. For prosecutors, it was validation. For the Schofields, it was devastation. It was the end of the life Leo had known and the beginning of a new one behind bars. State Attorney John Aguero sought the death penalty for Leo. Known for his aggressive approach and flair in the courtroom, Aguero often wore a small pin on his lapel. It was the shape of Old Sparky, aka Florida's electric chair, the exact place he hoped to send Leo. But before the jury made its recommendation, Leo was given the chance to speak directly to them. His words were forever memorialized in the transcripts. Quote, "It's hard for me to sit up here and plead for my life because you've already found me guilty. You've already taken it away. I'm telling you, you're making a mistake, a big mistake. I'm not guilty. I didn't kill my wife. I'm asking, please don't take it. I can show you. I can prove it to you." End quote. When the jurors returned, they spared his life. They recommended life in prison without the possibility of parole for 25 years. Judge Maloney accepted their recommendation. Leo Schofield was sentenced to life, not death. Deputies placed the handcuffs around his wrist, and Leo Schofield was led away to begin a life sentence for a murder he swore he didn't commit. His final words echoed in the courtroom. "You're making a mistake. I can prove it to you." What nobody knew then was that buried deep in an evidence box at the Polk County Sheriff's Office were four fingerprints that didn't belong to Leo Schofield. And 17 years after Michelle's murder, when those prints were matched to a convicted killer named Jeremy Scott, Leo Schofield finally got a chance to prove what he'd been saying all along. The following words were not part of a closing argument or a media interview. They were spoken quietly during a sidebar the jury never heard by Leo's attorney, Jack Edmond. Quote, "You know, it's a strange thing about this case. This case is being tried with the exact opposite emotions as normal criminal cases are tried. The state taking the emotional side, and the defense, the more straightforward one. Everything is backwards, and it's the way this case has been tried." End quote. Edmond wasn't criticizing prosecutor John Aguero. He was reminding the court of something fundamental: the danger of a case driven by feeling instead of fact. Because that's exactly what Leo Schofield's trial became: a case about who he was, not what he did. Edmond reminded the judge that there are rules of evidence with regard to testimony. His exact words: "They can't just grab something out of the thin air and say, let's put it in." In criminal law, there's a reason why character evidence is rarely allowed. Not because it's irrelevant, because it's too powerful. When jurors hear stories about anger, jealousy, or bad behavior, it changes the way they see everything else. Courts call that kind of evidence prejudicial, meaning it stirs emotion but doesn't actually prove anything. It invites jurors to feel a certain way instead of thinking a certain way. The kind of evidence that is allowed is called probative, meaning it directly provides a fact or helps establish the truth of what happened. In Leo Schofield's trial, that line vanished. Instead of proof about where Michelle was killed, when it happened, or who left physical evidence, jurors heard hours of stories that didn't establish the crime. They established a character. And once that image was formed, it became the lens through which the jury saw everything else. Leo's conviction was based largely on that character evidence. To convict someone beyond a reasonable doubt means there's no other reasonable explanation. So when proof of another suspect appears years later, it's alarming. If the wrong man is behind bars, it isn't just a mistake. It's a systemic failure. That may be exactly what happened here. 15 years after Leo Schofield was convicted, fingerprints from the orange Mazda were finally matched to a convicted murderer already behind bars. Enter Jeremy Scott. With a violent history full of abuse and neglect, Jeremy was living on the streets, building a rap sheet, and cycling in and out of juvenile detention beginning at the age of 11. At 15, Jeremy was arrested and charged with murder after an elderly woman was found bludgeoned and shot. His fingerprints at the scene. He bragged about it, then blamed the victim's ex-con son at trial. Although the jury acquitted him for the murder, when he was awaiting trial, he set fire to his jail cell and went to prison for arson. Once released from prison, his violence escalated. Assaults, robberies, and another killing in 1988 when he beat and strangled a man before stealing his car. Jeremy is now serving a life sentence without parole. Although Leo and Jeremy never met, their paths ran eerily parallel. Leo was arrested in June of 1988 for Michelle's murder. Jeremy's arrest for a separate murder was 5 months later. The same detective investigated them both. The same prosecutor tried them both. Two men, bound by coincidence and divided by fate, until that one piece of evidence tied them together. The four fingerprints had been there all along, lifted from the inside of the Mazda back in 1987. In December 2004, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement tested the prints and matched them to Jeremy. That's when a detective was assigned to reopen the case and investigate it. Jeremy denied any murder, but told the detective he'd stolen the stereo from her car, which is likely how his prints got there. That stereo, though, was still intact in all the pictures of the car. It was the speakers that had been taken. The detective's visit to Jeremy must have shaken him up, because as soon as the detective left, Jeremy went straight to the phone and called his grandmother. The first question he asked her on a line that was being recorded was if anyone had come to talk to her about a murder. When she said no, he told her, "They have my palm print." The similarities between the murders that Jeremy Scott was previously charged with and Michelle's are impossible to ignore. Each of the victims were targets of opportunity. A young girl, an elderly woman, and a sleeping man. Each was robbed of petty cash, and in the murders where Jeremy was old enough to drive, the victims' cars were stolen after. It seemed like a slam dunk. A known murderer forensically linked to a murder scene. His prints matched to the car, and overwhelming evidence that corroborated him as the killer. For the first time in years, Leo Schofield thought he was finally going to prove his innocence and go home. But he underestimated Prosecutor Aguero. Before an investigation into Jeremy Scott could even get off the ground, Aguero shut it down, said the claims were not credible, and kept Leo's conviction in place. The same prosecutor who fought to send Jeremy Scott to the electric chair now believed him when he told him he didn't kill Michelle Schofield. Never mind that Scott's fingerprints were in her car or that her body was found in one of his usual hangouts, barely a mile and a half from his trailer. It was a huge setback and disappointment for Leo and his family. But he wasn't going to give up. He kept fighting despite being met with resistance every step of the way. Several more years passed. Then, in July of 2016, almost 3 decades after Leo Schofield was arrested for the murder of his wife, Jeremy Scott confessed. And not just once, over and over. He confessed in a letter, then on a phone call. He told other inmates, attorneys, and even the state. Jeremy Scott took the stand and under oath confessed to the murder of Michelle Schofield. He said Leo was innocent and doesn't belong in prison, and that he's sorry for what he did. He offered to take a polygraph. He was remorseful, said it got out of hand and that he didn't mean to do it, it just happened so fast. Jeremy gave a detailed account of everything that happened that night. And for the first time in 30 years, Leo found out what actually happened to his wife. This is what Jeremy said. He had been out that night, drinking, partying, popping pills. He didn't have a car, so he was walking, and it was raining, so his clothes were wet. He was extremely intoxicated, drunk off of Thunderbird wine, which he said made him violent. Jeremy walked to the gas station, and that's when he saw Michelle. She was standing at the payphone talking to Leo. Jeremy approached Michelle while she was on the phone. She tells Leo she will come to pick him up from Vince's, says, "I love you," and hangs up. Then Michelle looked at Jeremy and asked if he was waiting on the phone. He told her no, but said he needed a ride. Michelle looked at him and asked, "Do I know you?" She thought she remembered him. Maybe they had met at a party. Jeremy said he didn't know, but said he needed a ride to a trailer nearby on Combe Road, right up the street. She agreed. It was on her way to pick up Leo anyway. They got in the Mazda, and Jeremy guided Michelle where to go. But as they approached the trailer, he got another idea. He directed her to a different place, past the trailers, a makeout lake where he had been before. When they arrived, he told her to go down the little dirt path behind the trees. There's a lake there. She pulled down the path but realized there's nothing there. She told Jeremy, nobody lives here. His response? People come here to make out. Michelle wasn't interested and told him she's married. Jeremy, annoyed, reached in his pocket to pull out a smoke. When he did this, his 7-inch hunting knife fell out. Michelle saw the knife and panicked. She started screaming and hitting Jeremy nonstop, and then Jeremy said he lost it. He started stabbing Michelle, but doesn't remember how many times. According to Jeremy, he didn't even know what happened. When it was over, he sat in the car for a few minutes and had a smoke. It was still raining. Then he dragged her body down to the canal, put her in the water, and got back in the car. He drove out of that area and got on I-4, but the car stalled out, so he pulled over to the side of the road. He found a towel in the car, wiped fingerprints from the dash and steering wheel, and grabbed his knife. He left the car there and walked to a store at the top of the hill. He put the knife and towel in a dumpster, making sure it was pushed deep down so it wouldn't be seen. Jeremy then was planning to walk toward Lakeland, but decided to go back and steal the car stereo system first. He took the speakers, then wiped his fingerprints off the doors. Then he returned to his trailer on Combe Road and passed out until the next morning. His story reveals things only the murderer would know, and all the evidence fits. Jeremy was released from prison 2 months before Michelle's murder and was living a mile and a half from the canal where she was found. He lived on the same road Michelle would have taken to pick up Leo that night. It's been confirmed that it was raining that night. And Jeremy approaching Michelle on the payphone at the gas station corroborates the last known sighting and location of her. It was also confirmed that Jeremy didn't have a car and would often hitchhike or bum rides with people. Jeremy's ex-girlfriend told investigators that just weeks after Michelle's murder, he took her twice late at night to the same canal where Michelle's body was found, confirming that he knew the location well. Jeremy said the first stab was to the back, which was corroborated by the medical examiner's testimony. He said she then fell out of the car, which corroborates the lack of blood in the car. He described dragging her to the canal, which matches the marks the medical examiner found on her body. In regards to the fingerprints, Jeremy said he wiped the car down, which would explain why even Michelle's prints were never found. The prints that were found were on the inside of the window and on a document in the back of the car. And he was even able to give the location of the car and described the store at the top of the hill. That store is likely the same one Leo called the police from after discovering Michelle's car. The knife used to murder his wife may have been just feet away from him, hidden in a dumpster, with the towel used to wipe away fingerprints. Everything lines up, and now there's overwhelming evidence, a forensic link with fingerprints, corroboration from every angle, and multiple detailed confessions. But once again, it wasn't enough to free Leo Schofield. How can that be possible? On one hand, there's a man who is not only a convicted murderer, but who is also forensically tied to the crime scene. He knows details only the killer could know and admitted to the crime more than once. Then there's Leo. No physical evidence linking him to the crime, no violent criminal history, and nearly 40 years of unwavering insistence of his innocence. And yet somehow, the court doesn't believe either of them or the evidence. Even though Alice Scott's testimony was deeply flawed and directly contradicts the physical evidence, her story is still treated as more credible than the one backed by facts. Jeremy Scott went on to say that Prosecutor Aguero told him that he had influence with the parole board and could make things happen for him if he just stuck to the story. According to Jeremy's statements, Aguero didn't want Jeremy to admit he killed Michelle. I guess that would mean he would have to admit he was wrong. And so were the jurors. Jeremy has now also been linked to the 1987 killing of a taxi driver. A different man was originally charged and said publicly he was being framed. Thankfully, he was acquitted. But his journey through the legal system took a toll on himself and his family, who had to sell everything to hire a big-shot attorney. That attorney? Jack Edmond. 34 years after the taxi driver's murder, evidence began to point towards Jeremy Scott, who eventually confessed and gave details that matched police reports and witness statements. The man had been shot and dumped from the car. Then Jeremy crashed it into a utility pole, knocking out power to the neighborhood. Murder, steal a car, cause chaos. It fits the MO. As for Leo, he made the most of his time in prison, using the time to better himself and help others. He got his high school diploma and even a bachelor's degree in Christian ministry. While incarcerated, he met a former state probation officer who began to help him fight for his freedom and led the push behind the fingerprints finally being tested. The two were married and adopted a daughter. In April of 2024, the Florida State Commission on Offender Review voted to award him parole after previously denying his applications. And Leo Schofield finally went home. Leo continues to play the guitar and even played at his 29th wedding anniversary celebration with his wife. He is still fighting to clear his name. The evidence remains. The fingerprints, the confessions, the doubt, unchanged, waiting. For Leo, the question stopped being about guilt or innocence long ago. It became about whether truth and justice still have power in the American judicial system. Maybe justice isn't found in a courtroom at all, but in the people who refuse to stop asking what really happened. Because if truth only matters when it's easy, then maybe justice was never the point. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, help is available through the National Domestic Violence Hotline by calling 1-800-799-SAFE or 1-800-799-7233.